Side 6, The Way of Zen, continuing on page 188. But Ryokan is also the poet of lice, fleas, and being utterly soaked with cold rain. On rainy days, the monk Ryokan feels sorry for himself. And his view of nature is all of a piece. The sound of the scouring of the saucepan blends with the tree frogs' voices. In some ways, Ryokan is a Japanese St. Francis, though much less obviously religious. He is a wandering fool, unself-consciously playing games with children, living in a lonely hut in the forest, where the roof leaks, and the wall is hung with poems in his marvellously illegible, spidery handwriting, so prized by Japanese calligraphers. He thinks of the lice on his chest as insects in the grass, and expresses the most natural human feelings, sadness, loneliness, bewilderment or pity, without a trace of shame or pride. Even when robbed, he is still rich, for the thief left it behind, the moon at the window. And when there is no money, the wind brings fallen leaves enough to make a fire. When life is empty with respect to the past, and aimless with respect to the future, the vacuum is filled by the present, normally reduced to a hairline, a split second in which there is no time for anything to happen. The sense of an infinitely expanded present is nowhere stronger than in Cha no Yu, the art of tea. Strictly, the term means something like tea with hot water. And through this one art, Zen has exercised an incalculable influence on Japanese life, since the Chajin, or man of tea, is an arbiter of taste in the many subsidiary arts which Cha no Yu involves. Architecture, gardening, ceramics, metalwork, lacquer, and the arrangement of flowers, ikebana. Since Cha no Yu has become a conventional accomplishment for young ladies, it has been made the subject of a great deal of sentimental nonsense, associated with brocaded young dolls in moonlit rooms, nervously trying to imitate the most stilted feelings about porcelain and cherry blossom. But in the austere purity of, say, the Soshu Sen school, the art of tea is a genuine expression of Zen which requires, if necessary, no further apparatus than a bowl, tea, and hot water. If there is not even that, Cha Do, the way of tea, can be practiced anywhere, and with anything, since it is really the same as Zen. If Christianity is wine and Islam coffee, Buddhism is most certainly tea. Its quietening, clarifying, and slightly bitter taste gives it almost the same taste as awakening itself, though the bitterness corresponds to the pleasing roughness of natural texture and the middle path between sweet and sour. Long before the development of Cha no Yu, tea was used by Zen monks as a stimulant for meditation, and in this context it was drunk in a mood of unhurried awareness which naturally lent itself to a ritualistic type of action. In summer it refreshed, and in winter warmed, those wandering hermit monks who liked to build grass and bamboo huts in the mountain forests, or by rock-filled streams in the gorges. The totally undistracting emptiness and simplicity of the Taoist or Zen hermitage has set the style not only for the special type of house for Cha no Yu, but for Japanese domestic architecture as a whole. Note, an influence combined with a native style which can still be seen at the ancient Shinto shrine of Ise, a style which strongly suggests the cultures of the southern Pacific Islands. End of note. The monastic tea ceremony was introduced into Japan by Eisai, and though its form is different from the present Cha no Yu, it was nonetheless its origin, and appears to have been adopted for lay use during the 15th century. From this, the Cha no Yu proper was perfected by Sen no Rikyu, 1518-1591, and from him descend the three main schools of tea now flourishing. Ceremonial tea is not the ordinary leaf tea, which is steeped in hot water. It is finely powdered green tea, mixed with hot water by means of a bamboo whisk, until it becomes what a Chinese writer called the froth of the liquid jade. Cha no Yu is most appreciated when confined to a small group, or just two companions, and was especially loved by the old-time samurai, as today by harassed businessmen, as a frank escape from the turmoil of the world. Note, since it is frequently my pleasure to be invited to Cha no Yu by Saburo Hasegawa, who has a remarkable intuition for issuing these invitations at the most hectic moments, I can testify that I know no better form of psychotherapy. End of note. Ideally, the house for Cha no Yu is a small hut set apart from the main dwelling in its own garden. The hut is floored with tatami or straw mats, enclosing a fire pit. The roof is usually thatched with rice straw, and the walls, as in all Japanese homes, are paper shoji, supported by uprights of wood with a natural finish. One side of the room is occupied by an alcove, or tokonoma. The position for a single hanging scroll of painting or calligraphy, together with a rock, a spray of flowers, or some other object of art. The atmosphere, though formal, is strangely relaxed, and the guests feel free to talk or watch in silence as they wish. The host takes his time to prepare a charcoal fire, and with a bamboo dipper pours water into a squat kettle of soft brown iron. In the same formal but completely unhurried manner, he brings in the other utensils, a plate with a few cakes, the tea bowl and caddy, the whisk, and a larger bowl for leavings. During these preparations, a casual conversation continues, and soon the water in the kettle begins to simmer and sigh, so that the guests fall silent to listen. After a while, the host serves tea to the guests, one by one, from the same bowl, taking it from the caddy with the strip of bamboo bent into a spoon, pouring water from the kettle with the long-handled dipper, whipping it into a froth with a whisk, and laying the bowl before the first guest, with its most interesting side towards him. The bowls used for Cha no Yu are normally dull-coloured and roughly finished, often unglazed at the base, and on the sides the glaze has usually been allowed to run, an original, fortunate mistake, which has been seen to offer endless opportunities for the controlled accident. Specially favoured are Korean rice bowls of the cheapest quality, a peasant ware of crude texture from which the tea masters have selected unintentional masterpieces of form. The tea caddy is often of tarnished silver, or infinitely deep black lacquer, though sometimes old pottery medicine jars are used, purely functional articles which were again picked out by the masters for their unaffected beauty. A celebrated caddy, once smashed to pieces, was mended with gold cement, and became the much more treasured for the haphazard network of thin gold lines which then covered its surface. After the tea has been drunk, the guests may ask to inspect all the utensils which have been used, since every one of them has been made or chosen with the utmost care, and often brought out for the occasion because of some feature that would particularly appeal to one of the guests. Every appurtenance of the Cha no Yu has been selected in accordance with canons of taste over which the most sensitive men in Japan have brooded for centuries. Though the choice is usually intuitive, careful measurement of the objects reveals interesting and unexpected proportions. Works of spontaneous geometry as remarkable as the spiral shell of the Nautilus or the structure of the snow crystal. Architects, painters, gardeners, and craftsmen of all kinds have worked in consultation with the Cha no Yu masters, like an orchestra with its conductor, so that their Zen taste has passed on into the objects made by the same craftsmen for everyday use. This applies most particularly to ordinary functional things, kitchen implements, shoji paper, soup bowls, common teapots and cups, floor mats, baskets, utilitarian bottles and jars, textiles for everyday clothing, and 100 other simple artifacts in which the Japanese show their good taste to best advantage. The Zen of the Cha no Yu comes out all the more for the purely secular character of the ritual, which has no liturgical character like the Catholic Mass or the elaborate ceremonies of Shingon Buddhism. Though the guests avoid political, financial, or business matters in their conversation, there is sometimes non-argumentative discussion of philosophical matters, though the preferred topics are artistic and natural. It must be remembered that Japanese people take to such subjects as readily and unself-consciously as we talk of sports or travel, and that their discussion of natural beauty is not the affectation it might be in our own culture. Furthermore, they do not feel in the least guilty about this admitted escape from the so-called realities of business and worldly competition. Escape from these concerns is as natural and necessary as sleep, and they feel neither compunction nor awkwardness in belonging for a while to the Taoist world of carefree hermits, wandering through the mountains like wind-blown clouds, with nothing to do but cultivate a row of vegetables, gaze at the drifting mist, and listen to the waterfalls. A few, perhaps, find the secret of bringing the two worlds together, of seeing the hard realities of human life, to be the same aimless working of the Tao as the patterns of branches against the sky. In the words of Hung Tzu Cheng, if the mind is not overlaid with wind and waves, you will always be living among blue mountains and green trees. If your true nature is the creative force of nature itself, wherever you may go, you will see fishes leaping and geese flying. Note, Hung's book of Vegetable Root Talk is a collection of wandering observations by a 16th century poet whose philosophy was a blend of Taoism, Zen, and Confucianism. End of note. The style of garden which goes with Zen and Shano Yu is not, of course, one of those ornate imitation landscapes with bronze cranes and miniature pagodas. The intention of the best Japanese gardens is not to make a realistic illusion of landscape, but simply to suggest the general atmosphere of mountain and water in a small space, so arranging the design of the garden that it seems to have been helped rather than governed by the hand of man. The Zen gardener has no mind to impose his own intention upon natural forms, but is careful rather to follow the intentionless intention of the forms themselves, even though this involves the utmost care and skill. In fact, the gardener never ceases to clip, prune, weed, and train his plants, but he does so in the spirit of being part of the garden himself, rather than a directing agent standing outside. He is not interfering with nature because he is nature, and he cultivates as if not cultivating. Thus, the garden is at once highly artificial and extremely natural. This spirit is seen at its best in the great sand and rock gardens of Kyoto, of which the most famous example is the Garden of Ryoanji. It consists of five groups of rocks laid upon a rectangle of raked sand, backed by a low stone wall and surrounded by trees. It suggests a wild beach, or perhaps a seascape with rocky islands, but its unbelievable simplicity evokes a serenity and clarity of feeling so powerful that it can be caught even from a photograph. The major art which contributes to such gardens is bonseki, which may well be called the growing of rocks. It requires difficult expeditions to the seashore, to mountains and rivers, in search of rock forms which wind and water have shaped into asymmetrical living contours. These are carted to the garden site and placed so as to look as if they had grown where they stand, so as to be related to the surrounding space or to the area of sand, in the same way as figure to background in Sung paintings. Because the rock must look as if it had always been in the same position, it must have the air of moss-covered antiquity, and rather than try to plant moss on the rock is first set for some years in a place where the moss will grow by itself, and thereafter is moved to its final position. Rocks picked out by the sensitive eye of the bonseki artist are ranked among Japan's most precious national treasures, but except to move them, they are untouched by the human hand. The Zen monks liked also to cultivate gardens, which took advantage of an existing natural setting, to arrange rocks and plants along the edges of a stream, creating a more informal atmosphere, suggesting a mountain canyon adjoining the monastery buildings. They were always sparing and reserved in their use of colour, as were the Sung painters before them, since masses of flowers in sharply varying colours are seldom found in the state of nature. Though not symmetrical, the Japanese garden has a clearly perceptible form. Unlike so many English and American flower gardens, they do not resemble a daub in oil colours, and this delight in the form of plants carries over into the art of flower arrangement inside the house, accentuating the shapes of single sprays and leaves rather than bunched colours. Every one of the arts which have been discussed involves a technical training which follows the same essential principles as training in Zen. The best account of this training thus far available in a Western language is Eugen Herrigel's Zen in the Art of Archery, which is the author's story of his own experience under a master of the Japanese bow. To this should be added the already mentioned letter on Zen and swordsmanship, Kendo, by the 17th century master Takuan, translated by Suzuki in his Zen Buddhism and its influence on Japanese culture. The major problem of each of these disciplines is to bring the student to the point from which he can really begin. Herrigel spent almost 5 years trying to find the right way of releasing the bowstring, for it had to be done unintentionally, in the same way as a ripe fruit bursts its skin. His problem was to resolve the paradox of practicing relentlessly without ever trying, and to let go of the taut string intentionally, without intention. His master at one and the same time urged him to keep on working and working, but also to stop making an effort. For the art cannot be learned unless the arrow shoots itself, unless the string is released wuxin and wunyan, without mind and without blocking or choice. After all those years of practice, there came a day when it just happened. How or why, Herrigel never understood. The same is true in learning to use the brush for writing or painting. The brush must draw by itself. This cannot happen if one does not practice constantly, but neither can it happen if one makes an effort. Similarly, in swordsmanship, one must not first decide upon a certain thrust and then attempt to make it, since by that time it will be too late. Decision and action must be simultaneous. This was the point of Dogen's image of firewood and ashes, for to say that firewood does not become ashes is to say that it has no intention to be ash before it is actually ash, and then it is no longer firewood. Dogen insisted that the two states were clearly cut, and in the same way Herrigel's master did not want him to mix the two states of stretching and releasing the bow. He instructed him to draw it to the point of fullest tension, and stop there without any purpose, any intention in mind as to what to do next. Likewise, in Dogen's view of Zazen, one must be sitting just to sit, and there must not be any intention to have Satori. The sudden visions of nature, which form the substance of haiku, arise in the same way, for they are never there when one looks for them. The artificial haiku always feels like a piece of life which has been deliberately broken off or wrenched away from the universe, whereas the genuine haiku has dropped off all by itself and has the whole universe inside it. Artists and craftsmen of the Far East have indeed measured, analyzed, and classified the techniques of the masters to such a degree that by deliberate imitation they can come close to deceiving, if it were possible, even the elect. By all quantitative standards, the work so contrived is indistinguishable from its models, just as bowmen and swordsmen trained by quite other methods can equal the feats of Zen-inspired samurai. But so far as Zen is concerned, the end results have nothing to do with it, for as we have seen all along, Zen has no goal. It is a travelling without point, with nowhere to go. To travel is to be alive, but to get somewhere is to be dead. For as our own proverb says, to travel well is better than to arrive. A world which increasingly consists of destinations without journeys between them, a world which values only getting somewhere as fast as possible, becomes a world without substance. One can get anywhere and everywhere, and yet the more this is possible, the less is anywhere and everywhere worth getting to. For points of arrival are too abstract, too Euclidean to be enjoyed, and it is all very much like eating the precise ends of a banana without getting what lies in between. The point, therefore, of these arts is the doing of them rather than the accomplishments. But more than this, the real joy of them lies in what turns up unintentionally in the course of practice, just as the joy of travel is not nearly so much in getting where one wants to go as in the unsought surprises which occur on the journey. Planned surprises are as much of a contradiction as intentional Satori, and whoever aims at Satori is, after all, like a person who sends himself Christmas presents for fear that others will forget him. One must simply face the fact that Zen is all that side of life which is completely beyond our control, and which will not come to us by any amount of forcing or wangling or cunning stratagems which produce only fakes of the real thing. But the last word of Zen is not an absolute dualism, the rather barren world of controlled action on the one side and the spontaneous world of uncontrolled surprise on the other. For who controls the controller? Because Zen does not involve an ultimate dualism between the controller and the controlled, the mind and the body, the spiritual and the material, there is always a certain physiological aspect to its techniques. Whether Zen is practiced through Zazen or Chanoyu or Kendo, great importance is attached to the way of breathing. Not only is breathing one of the two fundamental rhythms of the body, it is also the process in which control and spontaneity, voluntary and involuntary action, find their most obvious identity. Long before the origins of the Zen school, both Indian yoga and Chinese Taoism practiced watching the breath, with a view to letting, not forcing it, to become as slow and silent as possible. Physiologically and psychologically, the relationship between breathing and insight is not yet altogether clear. But if we look at man as process rather than entity, rhythm rather than structure, it is obvious that breathing is something which he does, and thus is, constantly. Therefore, grasping air with the lungs goes hand in hand with grasping at life. So-called normal breathing is fitful and anxious. The air is always being held and not fully released, for the individual seems incapable of letting it run its full course through the lungs. He breathes compulsively rather than freely. The technique, therefore, begins by encouraging a full release of the breath, easing it out as if the body were being emptied of air by a great leaden ball sinking through the chest and abdomen and settling down into the ground. The returning in-breath is then allowed to follow as a simple reflex action. The air is not actively inhaled. It is just allowed to come, and then, when the lungs are comfortably filled, it is allowed to go out once more, the image of the leaden ball giving it the sense of falling out, as distinct from being pushed out. One might go as far as to say that this way of breathing is Zen itself in its physiological aspect. Yet, as with every other aspect of Zen, it is hindered by striving for it. And for this reason, beginners in the breathing technique often develop the peculiar anxiety of feeling unable to breathe unless keeping up a conscious control. But just as there is no need to try to be in accord with the Tao, to try to see or to try to hear, so it must be remembered that the breath will always take care of itself. This is not a breathing exercise so much as a watching and letting of the breath, and it is always a serious mistake to undertake it in the spirit of a compulsive discipline to be practiced with a goal in mind. This way of breathing is not for special times alone. Like Zen itself, it is for all circumstances whatsoever, and in this way, as in others, every human activity can become a form of Zazen. The application of Zen in activity is not restricted to the formal arts, and on the other hand does not absolutely require the specific sitting technique of Zazen proper. The late Dr. Kanehiko Hashida, a lifelong student of Zen and editor of the works of Dogen, never used formal Zazen, but his Zen practice was precisely his study of physics, and to suggest his attitude, he used to say that his life work was to science rather than to study science. In its own way, each one of the arts which Zen has inspired gives vivid expression to the sudden or instantaneous quality of its view of the world. The momentariness of Sumi paintings and haiku, and the total presence of mind required in Chanoyu and Kendo, bring out the real reason why Zen has always called itself the way of instantaneous awakening. It is not just that Satori comes quickly and unexpectedly, all of a sudden, for mere speed has nothing to do with it. The reason is that Zen is a liberation from time, for if we open our eyes and see clearly, it becomes obvious that there is no other time than this instant, and that the past and the future are abstractions without any concrete reality. Until this has become clear, it seems that our life is all past and future, and that the present is nothing more than the infinitesimal hairline which divides them. From this comes the sensation of having no time, of a world which hurries by so rapidly that it is gone before we can enjoy it. But through awakening to the instant, one sees that this is the reverse of the truth.
It is rather the past and the future which are the fleeting illusions, and the present which is eternally real. We discover that the linear succession of time is a convention of our single-track verbal thinking, of a consciousness which interprets the world by grasping little pieces of it, calling them things and events. But every such grasp of the mind excludes the rest of the world, so that this type of consciousness can get an approximate vision of the whole only through a series of grasps, one after another. Yet the superficiality of this consciousness is seen in the fact that it cannot and does not regulate even the human organism. For if it had to control the heartbeat, the breath, the operation of the nerves, glands, muscles, and sense organs, it would be rushing wildly around the body, taking care of one thing after another, with no time to do anything else. Happily, it is not in charge, and the organism is regulated by the timeless, original mind, which deals with life in its totality, and so can do ever so many things at once. However, it is not as if the superficial consciousness were one thing and the original mind another, for the former is a specialized activity of the latter. Thus, the superficial consciousness can awaken to the eternal present if it stops grasping. But this does not come to pass by trying to concentrate on the present, an effort which succeeds only in making the moment seem ever more elusive and fleeting, ever more impossible to bring into focus. Awareness of the eternal now comes about by the same principle as the clarity of hearing and seeing and the proper freedom of the breath. Clear sight has nothing to do with trying to see. It is just the realization that the eyes will take in every detail all by themselves. For so long as they are open, one can hardly prevent the light from reaching them. In the same way, there is no difficulty in being fully aware of the eternal present as soon as it is seen that one cannot possibly be aware of anything else. But in concrete fact, there is no past or future. Making an effort to concentrate on the instantaneous moment implies at once that there are other moments. But they are nowhere to be found, and in truth, one rests as easily in the eternal present as the eyes and ears respond to light and sound. Now this eternal present is the timeless, unhurried flowing of the Tao. Such a tide as moving seems to sleep, too full for sound or foam. As Nan Chuan said, to try to accord with it is to deviate from it, though in fact one cannot deviate and there is no one to deviate. So too one cannot get away from the eternal present by trying to attend to it, and this very fact shows that apart from this present there is no distinct self that watches and knows it, which is why Hui Ko could not find his mind when Bodhidharma asked him to produce it. However puzzling this may be, and however many philosophical problems it may raise, one clear look is enough to show its unavoidable truth. There is only this now. It does not come from anywhere. It is not going anywhere. It is not permanent. But it is not impermanent. Though moving, it is always still. When we try to catch it, it seems to run away. And yet it is always here, and there is no escape from it. And when we turn round to find the self which knows this moment, we find that it has vanished like the past. Therefore the sixth patriarch says in the Tanjing, in this moment there is nothing which comes to be. In this moment there is nothing which ceases to be. Thus there is no birth and death to be brought to an end. Wherefore the absolute tranquillity of Nirvana is this present moment. Though it is at this moment, there is no limit to this moment, and herein is eternal delight. Yet when it comes to it, this moment can be called present only in relation to past and future, or to someone to whom it is present. But when there is neither past nor future, and no one to whom this moment is present, what is it? When Fa Chang was dying, a squirrel screeched on the roof. It's just this, he said, and nothing else. End of The Way of Zen by Alan W. Watts. Narrated by Patrick Horgan in the studios of American Foundation for the Blind, Incorporated, for the Library of Congress, September 1978. For special distribution as authorized by Act of Congress under Public Law 89522, with the permission of the copyright holder and the publisher, Vintage Books. If you experienced any difficulty with this recording, please tie a piece of string around one of the container straps before returning it. Place the defective recording in its container, braille side down for identification.